Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, December 9th, 2016. Panelists at the United States Institute of Peace say genocide in South Sudan is a very real threat.
This is top of the agenda for the next administration. We are handing this over. We are putting these plans in place. There needs to be a hell of a lot more messaging coming out of this administration than there has been thus far.
But a South Sudan Army spokesman denies that charge and also denies a charge that the army recently recruited militias in the Equatoria region.
These allegations are totally baseless. There are no 4,000 troops being trained in Luri.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Yesterday, we told you the U.S. Institute of Peace says genocide is a very real threat in South Sudan. Peyton Knopf, a member of the UN panel of experts on South Sudan and a part of yesterday's USIP panel, says he's concerned about mass displacement of internally displaced persons and refugees, triggered in part by massive food insecurity and what he calls the demonization of one tribe against another, creating deep fear in various communities across the country. He says the lack of security has led people to take drastic measures to protect themselves and their families.
It leads folks across the board, as we document at some length, to conclude that their only means of self-protection is proactive violence against other communities in self-defense, which is obviously a particularly volatile dynamic.
The humanitarian, political, and economic crisis in South Sudan is coming at a time when the United Nations, the United States, and the African Union are transitioning with new leaders. And that worries Cameron Hudson, director of the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. Hudson says the situation in South Sudan is so urgent that President Barack Obama should cancel Christmas for diplomats working in Juba.
We need to have messaging coming out from this administration saying this is top of the agenda for the next administration. We are handing this over. We are putting these plans in place. There needs to be a hell of a lot more messaging coming out of this administration than there has been thus far. People need to know that we are staying, that we are not going anywhere. We are passing this on, and that it is a priority.
John Prendergast, founding director of the Washington-based Enough Project, agrees.
Business as usual on the diplomatic front condemns the peace to almost certain escalation. We need to alter their trajectory. So that's one side of the coin, a diplomatic surge. Now, what's the other side? The other side is we got to create the leverage to support that diplomacy, to alter the cost-benefit calculations of people who are willing to commit mass atrocities to gain or stay in power.
For some time now, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, has been trying to convince the U.N. Security Council to enact an arms embargo on South Sudan. Akshaya Kumar, Deputy U.N. Director at the Human Rights Watch, says South Sudan's poor border security and large presence of small and light weapons are hard to control, but agrees that an arms embargo could help make a difference.
What an arms embargo will do immediately is two things. One, it will ground the attack helicopters that sit at the government of South Sudan's disposal and which are maintained and operated by foreigners. Once a globally enforceable arms embargo is in place, those foreigners, in our understanding, Ukrainians, will no longer legally be allowed to continue that business operation.
Former U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, Princeton Lyman, highlighted the growing trend of hate speech among South Sudanese. He says the USIP is working on researching the trend of online hate speech among South Sudanese, including studying the impact it's had on the ongoing violence in the country. The head of the South Sudan Army dismisses warnings that the country is on the brink of genocide. At a news conference today in Juba, SPLA Army General accused unidentified foreign diplomats, of failing to verify facts, and spreading rumors. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
SPLA General Paul Molong flatly denied in a written statement that the South Sudan government has deployed a 4,000-strong militia to carry out counterinsurgency operations in the Equatorial region. U.S. Ambassador to the Human Rights Council Keith Harper told a special session for the UN body in Geneva in late November that the South Sudan mobilized at least 4,000 militia members and, quote, is staging these fighters in Equatoria to begin conducting attacks, end quote. SPLA spokesman Brigadier General Lul Roy Kwong read a statement at today's news conference from General Malong.
We would want to make it crystal clear to all the people of South Sudan and the whole world that these allegations are totally baseless. There are no 4,000 troops being trained in Luri. This is completely false. In fact, the SPLA does not have any forces in Luri.
A report by a UN Commission on Human Rights following a 10-day visit to South Sudan warned there was already a steady process of ethnic cleansing underway in several areas of South Sudan through the use of starvation, gang rape, and burning of villages. On behalf of Molong, Kwong denied the SPLA burned hundreds of civilians' homes, including in Yei River State, as reported by the UN Human Rights Team.
On the alleged burning of villages, the SPLA would like to categorically repudiate these allegations as maliciously cooked to tarnish the good name of the SPLA and to portray the government as a partisan entity that does not care to protect all civilians. As the National Army, the SPLA takes its constitutionally mandated responsibility seriously.
The statement also criticized unnamed diplomats for what Malong calls their failure to verify facts about alleged abuses carried out by the military. Kwong says that kind of behavior could destroy the trust built between the South Sudan government and the international community.
We are utterly shocked and dismayed by the level of pettiness with which some foreign diplomats are credited to the Republic of South Sudan and who, by the virtue of their status, can verify facts, have simply accepted to live by rumors. They have become part of the confusion as they take rumors generated by the rebels' propaganda and give credence to these unfounded rumors. In fact, the UN Security Council made critical decisions on South Sudan on the basis of rumors.
Kwong says the recent report that warned of looming genocide in South Sudan was produced by what he called enemies of peace with an aim of dividing South Sudan along regional and ethnic lines.
The SPLA would like to issue a stern warning to all those in the international community who are propagating fear and issuing divisive statements in the country to refrain from such undertakings.
Kwong says those actions make it difficult to develop a working relationship that is grounded in trust. He also reiterated that South Sudan is a sovereign nation and will deal with internal and external aggressors in order to maintain law and order. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Nearly 12.5 million people were displaced in 21 African countries at the end of 2015. A new report blames that on conflict, violence, and natural disasters. The figures for 2016 probably won't be any better, as we hear from VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center says about 9,500 people are uprooted from their homes every day in Africa. Each displaced person, it says, represents a personal tragedy and a challenge for local, national, and international responders. Alexandra Bilak is director of the IDMC.
The reason why we decided to publish this Africa-specific report was also to respond to calls from our partners at the African Union who have been asking us to provide a more precise picture of this crisis at the continental level.
Africa is second only to the Middle East, where people are forced to flee.
It is suffering from repeated displacements caused by conflict and violence across a number of countries, but it is also affected by displacement caused by other triggers and other factors like natural hazards. We found that in 2015, 1.1 million of these displacements had been caused by disasters triggered by these rapid onset hazards like floods, Malawi being one of the countries affected, but also by slower onset disasters like droughts.
Bilak says some nations have perennial displacement problems.
Nigeria, DRC, South Sudan, CAR, Sudan, Somalia. When it comes to natural hazards and development projects, we're looking at a much more geographically comprehensive picture, I would say. Of course, when it comes to drought, we're looking mostly at the Horn of Africa and the Sahel. When it comes to development projects, although we don't have any comprehensive data at the moment, we do know that development is causing displacement across the board.
3.5 million people were displaced in Africa last year, bringing the total in the 21 countries included in the report to 12.4 million.
They are enormous numbers, but what they provide is really a sense of urgency, first of all. So it's really a question of putting this high up on policymakers' agenda. I think there's also an opportunity for different countries to learn from each other. I mean, some of the affected countries, because they've been affected by internal displacement repeatedly over the years, have actually developed very interesting national IDP policies and strategies.
The Kampala Convention is the informal name for the African Union Convention for the Protection and Assistance of Internally Displaced Persons in Africa. It was adopted in 2009. And requires governments to protect the rights of people forced to flee their homes due to conflict. While the displacement figures for Africa for 2016 are not final yet, Bilak is pretty sure they won't improve.
As the report says, it's very unlikely that that number will have gone down in 2016 simply because we know that there have been new displacements, new movements in 2016, but also because we know that the 12.4 million people currently living in displacement are not likely to have found a durable or a sustainable solution to their displacement. So it's likely that the numbers will be either similar or slightly higher.
The director of the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center says gaps remain in gathering data on people who've been displaced for years, even decades. Bilak says international attention can wane when humanitarian crises become protracted. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. What impact does the economic crisis have on disabled people in Imatong State? Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how do you know when you like someone?
My heart starts beating fast and I start sweating. Those are my signs.
Sometimes I do dream about him. The way we understand each other, through that I may know that that person, I like him.
It's a natural feeling though, but then you tend to feel it deep within you that you kind of click with that person. You move on with that person easily.
When I go extra miles in doing what I think ordinary I wouldn't have done for anyone, I will know I like the person.
I know I like someone when I feel comfortable with the person.
Yeah, feeling within me, like my feelings tells me that he's a good person. Yeah, so you can be around with him.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Some disabled people in Imatong State say the economic crisis triggered by South Sudan's conflict is making them more vulnerable to poverty. They say even though they are skilled and have always worked to earn a living, the ongoing economic crisis has driven away their customers, who now use the little money they have to buy food. Dimo Silva Arelo has more for VOA from Torit.
Torit resident James Wani, who lives in the Iluhum residential area, is paralyzed from the waist down and uses a wheelchair to get around. As a cobbler, he sits under a mango tree in Torit town, repairing shoes. In front of him stand two tables. One has carefully arranged consumer items for sale, including soap, packets of cigarettes, salt, and sugar. The other is his work table. Speaking in Arabic, Wani says he started working as a cobbler 6 years ago and managed to raise enough money to start a small retail business.
Before I start the business, my life was very miserable. But after I start, my life is improved. And people now consider me as somebody. In the past, even members of my family could not help me or give me anything. Only the needle I used to repair shoes was my brother.
But Wani says due to the economic crisis, he no longer earns much money, unlike the old days when he could earn more than 700 South Sudanese pounds in a day.
In
the past, at the end of the month when people have received their salaries, I used to make up to 700 South Sudanese pounds on a good day. On a bad day, I could make 500 South Sudanese pounds. It is only that these days, commodity prices are expensive in the market. For instance, when I buy a bar of soap at 60 South Sudanese pounds, I get a profit of 10 South Sudanese pounds. We buy a kilo of sugar at 120 South Sudanese pounds and make a profit of 30 South Sudanese pounds.
26-year-old Ibore Helen is disabled in both legs from disease and crawls on her knees because she cannot afford a wheelchair. Ibore cuts hair and knits bed sheets to earn a living. Speaking in her native Oruho language, Ibore says she hardly gets any customers these days because people have no money to spend.
This war makes me to think about death all the time. For example, the other time there was fighting here and other people fled, but I could not flee because I am unable to run. If there is more likelihood of dying now, I say let that come. Even food hunger is now imminent and I am just waiting for it because there are no people helping me.
Ibore says persons living with disabilities in Imotong State are often discriminated against.
Agriculture seeds were distributed to the public and I was not given because they think I cannot cultivate. This issue of disability is full of discrimination.
Amira Anurato is a mother of two disabled children. Basir Gino Juma's hands are paralyzed and Bonki Gino Juma is deaf. Speaking in Arabic, Amira says a local charity called Sara gave her a grant, which she used to start up a small business. She buys and sells food items in the local market. Speaking in Arabic, Anurato says she hopes to use the profits from her business to send her deaf son to a special school.
People in the market know this boy is deaf. If they need something, they will describe for him. He is among the people who can help me. But this one has a problem with the hands. I had wanted him to study, but there is no school for deaf people. He even has interest to learn. Every time he disturbs me, says, Mama, I wanted to go to school.
But Anurato says he has not been able to turn a profit for the past few months and doubts she will ever be able to send her deaf son to school. Joseph Andruga is another disabled resident of Imotong State. He is paralyzed in both legs and uses metallic crutches to get around. Andruga says he used to make handcrafts and repair shoes in Juba's custom market but lost his tools in 2006 when the market burned down. Andruga urges residents and government officials not to stigmatize people with disabilities.
God is the one protecting someone like me. Suppose the government has to see another place for disability. Like now, if your stick is broken, money is needed to go for repair. Like this, for how long will you wait? Maybe the shoes is finished, so that can be mended. Suppose every state should have a place so that if someone has a problem, he or she can go there.
Germano Omoring works for the Sara charity in Turit. Germano says his organization has started giving grants of up to 4,000 South Sudanese pounds each to about 25 disabled people so they can start up small-scale businesses.
We don't impose them, but they are the ones to come. Some of them say they are tea vendors who can do the tea, and then some are these small shops, and then others are making these soft drinks. And then at the end, something at least keeping them busy.
Last week, the National Ministry of Gender released a framework paper laying down the government's proposals for addressing problems facing people with disabilities and introduced a sign language dictionary to help people with hearing impairments. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Turit.
Information technology has its good and bad sides. South Sudanese in the diaspora have used social media to often post inaccurate information about the three-year-long conflict in their country. Misleading information can foster hatred between communities. John Tanza, host of South Sudan in Focus, continues our panel discussion with South Sudanese in the diaspora about how technology can fuel hate speech.
Somebody once told me that the reason why there's hate speech coming from these communities is because of the tribal groupings that started in diaspora. People are just discussing the other groups that they think are threatening them. And so that took time, and then it's creeping into the social media. Do you agree with that conclusion?
There is nothing wrong with people gathering and having conferences, because this is also, as I said before, it's a way of bringing a strategy and organizing oneself. At the end of the day, those are South Sudanese. They are promoting for good and the development of the community. South Sudan is not built, all of us, under one umbrella. So it's many divided tribes who individually and collectively we form the greater country that we have. So if those conferences are promoting development, is a good thing. And when it goes to the downside of actually trying to get hatred and violence, spread hatred among the community, that's where we have to actually address it. And I'm sure that most of it is promoting unity.
And dude, when we abuse the media, what is its setback on this issue that we are discussing, the issue of hate speech?
Well, I mean, once you abuse, just like anything else, once you abuse it, you're going to have some both short-term and long-term consequences. But I would like to say, I think as much as we focus on the negativity that we see on the media, there's also been a lot of positive things with technology. A couple of things. Number one, Thon McCare, the young man who was drafted by Milwaukee Bucks, he came from Australia, became a YouTube sensation. And that's how many scouts heard about him. And so he was able, that greatly shaped his trajectory to the NBA. Another thing is South Sudan Unite by the Luol Deng Foundation, where for 2 years now they've been bringing a lot of young people together. And one of the big things he did this summer, last summer, was celebrate people who are doing incredible things. So a young man who fell in coffee, musicians, different things, and bring them on stage and have them share their stories. And you see more of that, and you see many models whose stories are being shared and whose stories are being heard. And I think that's a testament to the power of social media and technology in general. And as much as the negative side, I think it can be combated with simple things such as celebrating one another on social media.
Yes, and Dennis, what is your take? Can you tell us the experience in Canada?
I would like to agree with some of the previous speaker about the technology. I think there is nothing wrong with the technology. We have been blessed by technology. We are able to communicate now live with you, three of us or four of us online. And I think it is a good thing that we can use it as a very powerful tool to bring positive things, to change things for the better. But technology has a downside of it, like anything else. If it is being abused, it can bring a very bad result. In Canada here, we have used technology a lot to bring people together for, like, teleconference. I remember when things were happening in Bar Ghazal, we were going for a rally. We were able to use Facebook Live to show what we were doing in rallying people. And then we were able to use a teleconference. I do agree that there is nothing wrong with those conferences, but we are keeping it only to ourselves, like within one group. Like what we are doing right now, I believe, like John Tanza has bring people from different areas, from Bar Ghazal, from Wau, and from maybe different tribes. I'm not sure.
There is a variety of different communities on the panel. I mean, I did that purposely to make sure that we are reaching out in a very positive manner.
Exactly. And this is what I would like to see. We'll say, okay, people from Balanda are like this. But that's not true. There are people from Dinka are good people. People from Balanda, they are really nice people. But it is until you integrate with those people, you tend to appreciate your diversity. You tend to know things that you cannot do.
Irene, yeah. Can you give us your perspective from Central Equatoria State?
Yeah, what I've noticed, this is Irene again speaking. What I've noticed about the media, how they are abusing the media and preaching hate through media.
When you say the media, when you say the media, I am in the media industry. That's an attack on me.
I know. Isn't that what we were talking about?
Yes.
Isn't that
sure,
like the abuse
sure,
of the media?
Sure,
yes.
Yeah. Yes. Tell us more about that. Tell us more how the media is making it worse.
They go on the media and they start preaching this hate speeches. And then, you know, the media is so fast. You can say something now and the whole world would know. And some of the people are just ready. They're just sitting there and waiting for you to. It's like you're giving them command. Okay, you guys go on and kill these people. Okay, they will go on and do it.
We heard from Irene, an accountant in Minnesota, Dr. Juku Wakasun, a medical doctor who heads the Western Bar El Ghazal community in England and is founder of United WOW, a social group. Dawdut Jok is the founder of the Dut Jok Youth Foundation, and Dennis Lisa, an accountant in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. The four South Sudanese were sharing their views about how technology can fuel hate speech. Next week, the panelists discussed the role of stereotypes, play in hate speech with my colleague, John Tanza. And that's our show for this Friday. We leave you with the song Africa Unite by Bob Marley and the Wailers. Africa Unite, cause we're moving right out of Babylon. Children of the Rastaman. We are the children of We've been listening to Bob Marley and the Wailers with the song Africa Unite. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. From all of us here at VOA, hope you have a peaceful weekend. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.